Good morning. Welcome to Talking About California. This morning we'll continue our series of discussions with Californians who talk about this place, this state, which is their home, and about their work here. I'm Cal Winslow. I'm your host. This morning we're very happy and pleased to have as a guest Malcolm Margolin. Is that how to say it, Margolin?
Yeah, that's good enough.
Yeah, it's good enough. Okay, just don't want to start. Anyway, he's an author and a publisher and a founder and the executive director of Heyday Books, which is an independent nonprofit publisher and cultural institution in Berkeley, California. It was founded in 1974 with the publication of his book, The East Bay Out, A Guide to East Bay Regional Parks. Malcolm's also the author and editor of 8 books, including The Ohlone Way, Indian Life in the San Francisco Monterey Bay Area, which we should come back to. It was named by the San Francisco Chronicle as one of the 100 most important books in the 20th century by a Western writer. There's a lot more that we can say here. Let me look down the CV. He's taught publishing courses at the University of California Extension. He's the co-founder of Bay Nature, a nonprofit quarterly magazine focused on the natural world of the San Francisco Bay Area. He's served on the boards of the Yosemite Association, the Alliance for California Traditional Arts, and on the publication committee of UC Berkeley's Bancroft Library. So there's even more here, but I'm going to skip it and we'll come back to it. Good morning, Malcolm. How are you?
I'm good, Joe. Where are you picking all this stuff up from?
Oh, I do my research as a writer. Did I get it wrong?
God, that's digging deep.
Okay, well, there's a lot more out there, Malcolm. You should be very, well, proud of yourself, of course. Malcolm, I thought I'd start off. So you're the editor and publisher of Heyday Press. It's a well-known regional press, I guess we might call it. There are many of them out here in Northern California. Maybe I could ask you, and we'll move around a bit on subjects, but maybe I could ask you to start off by just telling us a bit about this trade. Publishing. We've had lots of writers on the program, but writers need publishers. What about publishing today?
Well, there's the big world of publishing today. A lot of it takes place in New York. A lot of it takes place on a national scale, and I don't know too much about that, Cal. I don't hang around publishers very much. What we do about 24 books a year. We have bunches of events around them, a couple hundred events around them. We launch museum shows. I know what I do. The state of publishing in general, you know, it's a little bit like when people talk about the younger generation. Everything seems to be going to hell, and everybody seems to be stupid and shallow and corrupt. And then when I think about the people I know, they're all so wonderful. When I hear about publishing, when I read about publishing in the general media, it all seems to be so deteriorating. It seems to be so driven by money. It seems to be that electronic technology is pushing out the books. What I read about in the papers or what I hear about in the media sounds so dreadful. What I know is so damned lovely. It's that there's this flow of beauty that comes through the place. There are people that are sending us the most wonderful manuscripts. We do books. We've managed to get them to work. They find audiences. Don DeFine, I think that maybe as the dominant institutions are cracking, there's space for people to create their own worlds within it. And I think what we end up having is islands of competence and fun and beauty. And these things are what survive the general malaise that seems to be afflicting things.
And so Heyday is that place for you, I guess. That's, how did Heyday come about? And maybe you could tell us a little bit about the nuts and bolts of it.
About the nuts and bolts of how it came about?
Well, both, of how it came about and how it works.
Of how it works?
Yeah.
Well, it came about, it was back in 74, and you live in a place where people moved out into the country to become self-sufficient. I always said that the one mistake I never made in this world was I never moved up to Mendocino to raise goats. That I've made every other mistake, but I never made that one. But the feeling of self-sufficiency was in the air. People were, there was that wonderful book, VW Repair for the Complete Idiot. There were, the Whole Earth Catalog was out. People were making their own breads and their own, having home births, and there was a kind of self-sufficiency around there. And I started out as a writer. I sold a book to Houghton Mifflin for $10,000. I spent the year hiking around, and I got into doing stuff that was so local and so regional that nobody else wanted to publish it. So I learned to typeset, I learned to design, I learned to get stuff printed, I learned to get stuff into bookstores. I was dealing with my own stuff for several years. And I loved the whole thing. I mean, I loved writing as a creative act, but so is designing, and so can selling be. Capitalism has given selling and marketing a bad name, but it's somehow or other getting your ideas out through the channels into people's heads. And I love the creative part of it. I think it could be done with integrity. And I ended up just getting into more than writing. And then after several books that I wrote myself and typeset, and I was a one-man band. I was having books stored under the kids' beds. I was working out of the house for many years. And then after about 7 or 8 years of this, I got lonely. I just wanted to get out of the house. And I set up an office, and I began to take in other people's manuscripts. And then one thing led to another, and 40 years passed.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of builds up around a core of having fun, of telling truth, of... You know, at the core of it, the funny thing is, Cal, that at the core of it was this desire for self-sufficiency. I didn't want to work for anybody else. I was not going to hold a job. I was not going to have to report to anybody. I was going to do what I wanted in this world. And after 40 years of struggling for independence, I'm the most dependent guy you've ever met. We get grants. We have readers. I have people working for me. We have reviewers. We have people give me radio time so I can talk about what we do. I'm dependent on everybody. And the word for that dependence is community, and somehow a community has been built up around it, and it's utterly lovely.
Well, that's a nice way of hearing it. We had a couple of weeks ago, I think a colleague friend of yours, Leanne Hinton, on the program.
Oh, yeah.
And one of the things that she said about Hey Day Books was that if she sent you something, she knew you'd do it right. Do you know what she was talking about?
Huh?
Do you know what she meant by that?
Well, I know what I would mean by it.
Yeah, okay.
I started out as a writer, so when writing comes to us, you know. There's this whole necessary business of finances and money. There's this whole business of everybody being rushed. There's the sense that I have that if somebody comes to me with something that is so meaningful to them, that they've worked on for years, that their identity is tied up with this thing, their ambitions are floating on it, that if I screw it up, I'd be ashamed to see them. And it's working with them to make... If there's a principle that we have, the principle is that when we get a manuscript, you don't look for its weaknesses, you look for its strengths, and you build around the strengths of the manuscript, and the weaknesses go away. And it's somehow or other something comes in, and we'll spend a tremendous amount of time thinking about it, and looking at it, and seeing where its heart is, and seeing where the breathing is, and seeing where the soul of it is, and building the book around, and the whole promotion around the best parts of that book. And I think that's maybe what she means by doing it right.
So maybe you could tell us, just give us a hint about the East Bay Out. That looks like one of your first projects.
Yeah, that was the first book that I did with Hay Day.
What was that about?
So look, it was 1973. Houghton Mifflin had given me $10,000. I got fired from the one job I ever had, which was working for East Bay Regional Park District for 3 years. I had turned 30. I biologically turned 30 in 1970, but it took me 3 more years to actually come to terms with it. My oldest kid was born in 1970, and he'd been sick for several years, and he got better. I was fired. I had some money. It was the most wonderful year. I just hiked the hills. I just wandered around. I was so in love with how beautiful the world was and how marvelous it was to be free that I would wake up in the morning and I could go out into this flowery meadows. I could go along the bay shore. I could think about things. And I hiked around the East Bay and I took some notes. And at the end of it, I compiled these notes into a book called East Bay Out, which is it was a love letter to being alive. It was a love letter to the place where I lived. It was a celebration. It was something so... It was the recognition that at this particular moment in my life, everything was working and everything was beautiful. And it was gratitude. And I ended up typesetting the book and designing the book. And I had... And it was a lyrical guide to... It didn't tell you what the parking fees were. It didn't tell you what the hours were. It didn't tell you that if you hike 3.7 miles along such and such a trail, you come to a fork and you take the trail to the left. It wasn't that detailed thing. It talked about trees and plants and the rhythms of the place and the history of the place and the history of the people that lived there. And it was quirky and it was personal and... It was completely unconventional. Back in 74, there weren't that many regional guides around. The world has now become lousy with them of various sorts. But back then, the hiking revolution had just started, and people were just beginning to buy tents and backpacks and get out into the world. And it came at the right time. We ended up selling 100,000 copies over several years. It's been out of print for many years. It was a... the whole thing was a gift. That year, that book, the whole thing was a gift.
And I was going to ask a sort of mundane response to that lovely description. It's not in print, though.
No, it's not in print. When I started doing other people's books, I thought I was such a Renaissance man that I could write, that I could do other people's books, that I could have a family, that I could have a personal life, that I could do everything. And there's that whole business, you know, I don't know if you noticed this, Cal, but there are only 24 hours in a day. And whoever invented this system didn't realize how much there is to do. So things slip, and I've been busy publishing other people's books more than my own. My own has slipped.
Well, I'm sure that that we could find it if we wanted to and tried hard enough, and I hope that our readers will. The East Bay Out. We're talking to Malcolm Margolin here. I see in trying to, you know, look through the notes that I've picked up about your history, I see that there's an interest which develops, seemingly from this vantage, very early on, and that is an interest in the native peoples of California. And what stands out in these notes is an early publication called News from Native California. Could we move on to that subject?
Yeah, I'd already written several books on California Indians. And in 1980, 87, I started News from Native California as a magazine. And like so much else that has happened around me, there was no strategy, there was no plan, there were no flip charts, there were no focus groups, there was no sense of what we were going to have in 3 years. I mean, I just kind of bumbled into it. And I bumbled into it because a friend of mine, Vera Mae Fredrickson, had been working up at Cal at the Anthropology Museum, and they let her go, and she had some time on her hands. And in 74, you didn't have these computer networks, you didn't have... The Indian people were more isolated than they are today. And I was forever going around, and I was hearing that there had been a wonderful show that I had missed. There had been a wonderful meeting that I'd missed. There was a great ceremony that I had just missed. And I thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a calendar of events for all of California? So you knew that on April 30th, there would be, on, say, the weekend of the April 27th, 28th, You'd know what was happening. You know that you could go to the Maidu Center in Roseville and there'd be a celebration there. You know that there's going to be something at Alcatraz. And I started out, I wanted a calendar of events. And Vera Mae and I went out to a Chinese restaurant to plan this calendar of events. And I think it was over Kung Pao chicken and rice that we ended up discussing what the calendar of events would look like, and then there might be some space if we did it as a 8.5 by 11 sheet, four sides. There might be some space, and maybe Frank Lapina, the Wintu artist, would like to write about what was happening in the art world. And then maybe there was a Cherokee lawyer, Logan Slagle, would like to write a political column. And I sketched it out on a napkin, and somehow it was born from that. We ended up with a magazine, and it's been, and it developed into something in 1987. There were still people around that had been brought up by people that were in California before the gold rush. There were people in their 80s, 90s, people like Wallace Burroughs, who was near 100, that they had been brought up by people that remembered California before the whites came. And you talk to these people, and they were so marvelous. It was a different tone. It was a different stance. It was a different approach to life. There was a humor. There was a connectedness. There was a specificity. There was a sense of sadness at the loss. There was a sense of violence. There was a sense of the beauty of the world, a sense of the modesty of the human endeavor. And I love that generation of people. I wanted to do, and they were dying off, and I wanted to do memories of them. And it started out to eulogize a fading generation, but out of it we began to notice that there were revivals going on. There were people learning languages. There were people studying basketry. And it became and I set out to write a eulogy, but I ended up becoming a witness to something that was being born, to a revival that has been so breathtakingly touching and beautiful that I just wanted everybody to know about it.
Your book, The Ohlone Way, would it fit into what you've just been talking about? Indian life in San Francisco, Monterey Bay area, a little earlier.
No, I don't
guess.
Think that it fit in. I think that it was a precursor. I think I started it when the East Bay Out came in 1974. It came out and we were broke and I needed a quick book to write. And I thought I would write a quick book about Indian life in the Bay Area. I didn't even know there were any Indians around, and I just started writing the book, and then I began to meet Native people, and then I began to get into the community. But it was much more a look at what Indian life had been like before the coming of whites. It was much more a classic reconstruction of village life, of hunting, of fishing, of funerals, of religion. It was trying to figure out what that old world had been like was my main concern on that. And that still is a concern, but I become so much more personally fascinated by people that I've met that have rebuilt the roundhouses, that have relearned the languages, that are singing the songs, that are carrying on the traditions, that the mud, the presence of living people has just swept me away. But the Ohlone Way was much more focused on the past.
I see. This is KZYX. Our program this morning is talking about California. I'm Cal Winslow, your host this morning. We're very happy to be talking to Malcolm Margolin. Malcolm is a editor and a publisher. He's the publisher of Heyday Press in Berkeley. And we've just been talking about some of his work. But maybe just for readers who might not be familiar, you could tell us a bit about the subject of your book, The Ohlone People. Who were they, and what was interesting to you about them?
Well, they were the people that look, Cal, the California Indian world is so complicated that I wrote that book when I was in my mid-30s, and I didn't know very much. And consequently, you can make statements when you don't know very much that when you get older and when you learn more, you have trouble making. And there were wonderful insights in there. The Ohlone people it was a language group. What was called by linguists the Costanoan language, and it was from the San Francisco Bay Area down through Monterey Bay and Big Sur. And in that Ohlone language group, there was something like 8 or 9 separate languages. There were 40 or 50 or so separate independent political entities. They lived with tremendous variety, and they were all lumped together as Costanoans or Ohlones. And the name and the concept is an artificial construct. It was placed upon people by anthropologists in later years. It's useful because you have to. If you want to say something, you've got to kind of pin it to a name and pin it to a location. But it's a fuzzy concept. And and they're still around here. They were missionized. The missions came in very early. They came in the 1780s, 1770s, 1780s, 1790s. The missions were set up. Indians were drawn into it. Most of them died, and there was just tremendous loss of culture, loss of language. By the time anthropologists came around at the turn of the 20th century, the languages had been severely diminished, and the cultures had been shattered with some remnant practices around. And I came to Berkeley in the late 60s. In a VW bus, and I'd been living here for all these years. By the time 1974, I started the Ohlone Way. I hadn't realized there were Indians around. There were Native Indians. I knew there were urban Indians because of Alcatraz, but these were people that had moved in from elsewhere, and these Native people I didn't realize they were still here. And I think what fascinated me. What fascinated me going into it was the hippie world and this sense that there were another people that had lived here in what I assumed was a simple life that was ecologically harmonious, that was sustainable for many years, that had its beauty, and that wasn't the society that I was looking at. The more I got into it, the more I realized that it was complicated, that it was nuanced, that it was highly evolved. I didn't understand the subtleties of it when I began, and I understood more subtleties when I got out of it all. But the what you get out of it is another way of living, another way of thinking, another way of being human. And it stretches the imagination. It stretches, and it's not like I want to be that kind of human being. But when you realize that there are so many different ways of being human, so many different ways of happiness, so many different roads that can be taken, it just frees your mind up from the advertising that's coming out of the dominant culture that tells you who you have to be in order to be healthy.
And another book, Living in a Well-Ordered World, Indian People of Northwestern California. That might be of interest to people up this way. Is that right? Could you?
That was, I think what you're referring to is a supplement that appeared in News from Native California that we did with the Redwood National Park.
Right, that's what it says.
And that was part of the magazine. That was, I think, it was something like 16 pages, and we overprinted it and gave it to them for distribution. And I went up there, I interviewed Indians that were living there.
Living where?
Up in the Redwood region, up around Humboldt.
Yeah.
Humboldt and Del Norte counties.
Mm-hmm.
And we interviewed people from, and I was just up there last weekend with Merk Oliver at the mouth of the Klamath River at Requa, with Willard Carlson along the Klamath River with Brian Tripp and Porty Blake and all these marvelous artists and craftspeople and people that are preserving culture, people that don't know they've been defeated, people that are still out there fighting great battles and demanding their rights, and just such a vigorous and amazing world out there.
And what kind of rights are you talking about then?
Fishing rights, hunting rights, rights to be themselves, rights to their land, rights of access.
Right. And Native Ways, California Indian Stories and Memories?
That one, I did a book called The Way We Lived, which was a collection of California Indian stories and reminiscences. Because when I wrote The Ohlone Way, I realized that I was this white guy from Boston writing about Indians, and I was doing the best I could. I then began to feel that it would be a whole lot better, and not just politically better, but better in terms of truthfulness to have Indian voices do this. So I collected material from Indians, telling stories, reminiscences, essays, and I created a book called The Way We Lived, California Indian Reminiscences, Stories, and Songs, to explore Indian culture from an Indian perspective. And then Native Ways was drawn from that as a children's edition of it.
Mm-hmm. And so News from Native California, is that still something that's regularly published?
Damn right.
And maybe just before we, so we don't forget, how does one get in contact, find a way to?
I think that we have a website. It's www.heydaybooks.com. And people can go to that website, and then there are various little doors and windows through which you can crawl in and find stuff.
Okay. But Heyday's about more than just Native California. What other topics would you say that you focus on or that are part of your publishing world?
Well, you know, we've maintained, it's been regional. We deal with California. And it's not that this is the limits of my personal interests. I don't have much organizational ability. I tend to deal with people that I like and people that I know. And this limits what we do because it's a big world out there. So you end up being connected to a smaller region. And we end up doing stuff on politics, on art, on natural history, on history, on different ethnic groups. We recently published a whole bunch of Japanese American material from the internment period and onward, and we just published a couple of books on California's newest immigrants, the Hmong. And we published a book with the Hmong American Writers Association, Hmong American Writers Circle, where these newest immigrants to America are talking about what they're seeing. And it's just so interesting comparing it to the Indian material, where in the Indian material you have California's deepest and oldest sense of itself. And with the Hmong, you have America's newest perception of what this world is all about. And I want to get the Hmong together with some California Indians and have some discussion about this range of views. We do stuff on...
What's the Hmong for our listeners, just in case? How did you come to be interested in them, and who are they and where are they?
The Hmong were... let's see, the name of the book is... What is the name of that book? I'm blocking on it at the moment.
Just go ahead.
We did a lot of publishing in the Central Valley. We did a book called Highway 99 of the literature and of the Central Valley, and we worked with the California Council for the Humanities and had tours at museums and libraries for the literature of the valley. We've done stuff. There's the peach farmer, Masamoto. He was a good friend. We did a couple of his books. We've done books on envisioning the Central Valley, on how the Central Valley has been envisioned with art and mapping and photographs. We had some exhibits. We've done tons of books on the Central Valley, so I know a whole lot of people down there. And I think it was through Masamoto, I met a Hmong writer. I began to meet several Hmong writers. I met Gary Snyder, introduced me to somebody. Masamoto introduced me to somebody. And then at one point or other, the Hmong American Writers Circle got in touch with me, and they said that they were compiling an anthology. Would I work with them to publish it? And I certainly did. I certainly did.
So you met them in the Central Valley.
I met them in the Central Valley, and they tend to. There's a big community around Fresno.
Agriculturalists?
A lot of them have small farms. A lot of them are they're new immigrants, so they have the kind of jobs that new immigrants tend to have. Some of them have gone to college, and some of them teach. Some of them work lousy jobs for low pay and don't speak English very well. One of the most amazing things was Masamoto and I, we went around to high schools in the Central Valley and created after-school literary programs, writers groups. And I remember there was one in Merced that we were part of, where there were about 16 kids that would get together after school and read each other their poetry and read each other their prose. And I looked around at these 16 kids, and I realized that not a single one of them was going home to a household where English was spoken. It was Hmong, it was Chinese, it was Spanish, it was one of the indigenous languages of Mexico. It was Hindi, it was Indonesian. I mean, they were all from other places, and there was this immigrant vitality that looked to express itself through writing that I found so touching. I was just so moved by it.
And for us to try to imagine you and your work, if we can do that, what did you have in mind when you said you wanted to get these people together with Native peoples, with other peoples, other immigrants? What were you or are you envisioning?
Hey, listen, we do about 20 to 25 books a year. We have a couple of hundred events. We have events that the most wonderful person working for me is Lillian, who runs our events and does so with a grace and an ease. Things just pop up out of the ground and people get together. And we had last week we had an event with several hundred people at the California Historical Society. We had Peter Coyote come to narrate it. We had about 15 writers for an anthology that we did of New California writing, doing quick readings. This week we've got a couple of poets coming to the office to read. What I'm picturing is something like I'm not sure how we'll end up doing it, but it's something where we're continually having panels that we sponsor either at our office or somewhere else, It may very well be that we'll sponsor it through the Hmong community and invite some California Indian people that we know to partake, or we'll have it at a California Indian venue like the Maidu Cultural Center, and we'll invite some Indians from there and invite the Hmong to come up. I'm not sure how we'll do it, Cal. But the
And are these events, do they take place statewide? Are they?
Yeah, we have events all over the place.
Yeah. We're ever up this way?
You know, not enough.
Hmm.
Not enough. That's, I apologize.
Oh, no.
Hey, let's get together and do something, Cal.
All right. And maybe listeners could let us know if they have any ideas. So when I see another volume, New California Writing, is that, connected to what you've just talked about with your events in the last couple of weeks?
Yeah, we've had for the last 3 years, we've done an anthology of the best of California writing that we've called New California Writing. And we have our wonderful editor, Gail Watua, searches and keeps her eye out for things. We've got networks of people that we know that send us stuff. And it's an anthology of the best of the California writing. And I'm not sure we're going to keep it going. It may be evolving into something else. We're discussing it now. But it's been everything from excerpts from novels, essays, blogs, letters. I mean, it's, wherever we find written stuff that sparkles, that excites, that stretches the mind, that makes you laugh. I love laughter. So anything that makes you feel, anything that surprises you, anything that pulls the rug out from under your feet and makes you see something new. So we've had three volumes of this, and
so you go out and find people. It sounds like you're not just sitting there waiting for the manuscript to fall in your lap.
What I view my job as, stuff does come to us. I mean, stuff comes to us from strangers, and we review it, and sometimes we publish it. Rarely, but we do. What I view my job as is to be out in the world bringing beautiful things back into the office for people to work on. And I think that the image that people have of a publisher is that we shape work, and this is true. The work also shapes us. When something beautiful comes in and people work on it and it's soulful and it's capacious and it's passionate and it's hard and it's truthful and it's gorgeous, the people that work on it absorb some of that. And I just love it's a little bit like a hunter bringing back some wonderful food for the family. I love going out in the world and coming back and saying, hey, guess what I just caught? And it's like a fish. I mean, look what I just got us. And it'll be something to work on. It'll be people to meet. It'll be a whole new adventure.
And this is KZYX. Our program is talking about California. Our guest today is Malcolm Marglin, who's the publisher, editor of Heyday Books. We've been talking about his work as a publisher. We've been talking about the books that are available from Heyday Press. This might be of interest to you, this question, or maybe not. Let me pose it. It's a little different. Do you ever think of California writing as in a larger context? Are you part of a larger California writing? You just mentioned Gary Snyder. You're too young to know a lot about the Beat Area era, for example.
I'm 72.
Just a kid. So what do you see my question? Is there a larger California writing that's coherent at all that you think about?
Let me think about this. There's, there's a larger California writing that is perhaps more social than it is ideological or programmatic. I mean, there's Gary, there's the Beats, there's the Kenneth, derived from Kenneth Rexroth. There was the contribution of Duncan and Spicer back in Berkeley. There was strands that go back to Sterling and Joaquin Miller and Jack London and Ina Kulbrith and people like that. There are strands you can follow. But there's also, there's a social world. You've got up in your area people like Jim Dodge and Jerry Matian and Freeman House and writers from that area that are connected to Snyder, that are connected to Peter Berg, that are connected to one another. And they've had tremendous influence on the country. They've they often don't get credit, and they often don't get the sales that they should get. The distribution is not as... The capacity to distribute books isn't that great, but ideas get out of the books. Images get out of the books. They have lives of their own. They go on to computerized networks. They get... Stuff gets stolen. I get stuff stolen from me every day. It's wonderful. Just watching stuff seep into the dominant consciousness of the culture at large. I think there is something in California. There's what Stuart Brand had done with the Whole Earth Catalog. There's wonderful writings of... When I grew up in Boston, the most influential writer that I knew was Saroyan. I was in love with Saroyan. I couldn't believe that somebody would write so beautifully and make you feel that way. And Steinbeck. And this... I'd be hard put to find what the common threads of theme and practice are, but there's something in the cumulative tonality of it all, in this sense of reinvention that California's always had, that creates a coherence and creates something that has stamped itself on the literature and knowledge of the world.
We were just talking to Freeman House this week about coming on the program. He's, for listeners, lives up in the Matole. And,
yeah, he lives up in Petrolia.
Yeah, and is the author
of... The Muse of Petrolia.
Yeah, Totem Salmon. Wonderful, large volume, Two Peoples, One Place. Do you know that?
Yeah, he wrote that with Ray Raphael.
Right.
And it's the most... Any culture ought to be so grateful for having minds like Freeman House and Ray Raphael writing a book like that and working so hard on it. That's an amazing book.
And yet, as you were just saying, in a way, doesn't really get around much, but is just as important all the same. Another turn in the discussion for you. This one, it would be interesting to hear your take on this. Some years, you're a very enthusiastic, positive man, we can all hear. Several years ago I think before really the internet, I heard a very distressing discussion of books, which was led by a fellow named Andre Schifrin.
Oh, I knew Andre.
Yeah, at the New Press.
Yeah.
Concerned about the number of homes in which there was not a single book, about the numbers of people who had never read a book cover to cover. I wonder, that was probably in the 80s. I wonder, do you think that was that a something to worry about, and have things changed, better, worse? As someone who's producing books, do you wonder about topics like that?
No.
No, that's...
No, I don't give a damn about it. That I do what I do, and I've always been self-defined. I hope there's somebody out there that reads them. There's nothing I can do about these major cultural and social issues. If I want to worry, I've got things closer to home to worry about. I think that there's a sense that literature is in some ways supply-driven rather than demand-driven. There's a whole lot of it being written. There's a whole lot of people out there in writers' programs. There's a whole lot of writing that comes out. And there's not that many people at the other end that want to read it. So there's always that sense of more is available than there are readers for it. And there's this constant complaint that somebody has worked for years to do something and they can't get it published, or they get it published and they can't get it read. And it's just inherent in the fact that there's so many people love to write, and time is limited, and people are distracted, and there's competing media, and the world is not perfect, and it's a continual frustration for a publisher when you get something of absolute incontrovertible beauty and you can't get it out into the world, that people don't listen to it. So you end up blaming the world. You end up blaming the state of the culture. But the problem is there's just too much beauty. There's just too much around. There's just, we're drowning in it. That and there's all of this people, the miseducation of people, the betrayal of the best part of us, that's all true, but it's always been true.
And the internet, does that fit into something to worry or not worry about? Is the answer no again?
Hey, we're doing books in print form. We're also doing the same book in electronic form, because I'm tired of having people ask me what I'm doing about e-books. So I say now we're doing e-books, and we do e-books. I don't know. I mean, we do e-books. Some people read them that way. And my job as a publisher is to get stuff out into the world. If I had to write it on napkins and fold the napkins up into big paper airplanes and fly them from skyscrapers, I would. I mean, you just get the information out there with whatever channel is available, and you try to stay loyal to the soul and the heart of what you're doing. And if people are going to be want to sit in front of screens and read it in front of screens, or carry around little boxes in their pockets and read it on little boxes, bless them. I'll give them what they want.
Okay, and maybe we could turn, from the time we have left back to, where you began and the questions of the California landscape that you're still publishing about. We began the discussion with East Bay Out. I was just looking at, there's a new film out about Marin County, and I was looking through my copy of Dick Walker's book on the country and the city. Do you maintain an interest? I see John Muir's on the reading list as well. Do you maintain an interest in what you began with and the landscape and beauty of the area?
Damn right I do. I mean, what I'm so aware of is it's springtime that we're talking. The wildflowers are out. I'm going to be making certain that anybody that misses the wildflower season is an idiot. I'm personally interested in it. I'm interested in natural history. I'm interested in the evolution of landscape. I'm interested in all of those problems. At the same time, I grew up in an urban area in Boston, and I've got other interests, I've created a world for myself where I can be completely inefficient and all over the place and get away with it. That what I love about the publishing that we do is people come to me with the best of their ideas, the most beautiful of their thoughts, the most highly evolved of their work and their product. They come to me at the peak of their lives, and I get into different worlds. That we're doing a book on the Pleistocene, on California as it was at the end of the Ice Age. So part of me is into the Ice Age. We're doing a book on a Pitt River Indian woman that lived up around Alturas, and I'm getting into what that life was like. We're doing a book on civil liberties. So I get into these fights for civil liberties. Each book is a different. You get into somebody else's mind, somebody else's subject, somebody else's sense of the world, and I just love it. It's like tourism. It's like travel. You get into these different places, and you absorb it, and you learn. And so I'm interested in landscape. I'm interested in natural history. I'm interested in natural history, and but how humans have affected it over the years, and what it is a changing entity. That landscape has never stayed the same. No amount of legislation, no amount of practice is going to keep land and the plants and the animals on it stable. It's inherently unstable. And what is it? What are the forces that we have to preserve? The forces of beauty and fecundity and flexibility and change that allow for a healthy landscape that isn't going to be the landscape that there was a couple of hundred years ago.
Okay, and so following from that, I see here the Earth Manual. Here's a how-to book, how to work on wild...
That was the first book that I wrote in 1973.
Really? It doesn't have... my notes don't have a date, so... Wild Land Without Taming It, what's that mean? A guide for landowners, conservationists, youth group leaders...
This was a book I wrote in 1973, and the one job that I had was working for East Bay Regional Park District, mm-hmm. where I led kids on nature walks and did a lot of conservation work that involved wildlife habitat improvement. It involved planting trees. It involved managing landscape for various purposes, stopping erosion. And it had to do, I think, that the part of it was born of a hippie era that you kind of let things alone and they'll take, and everything will find its way. But it had to do with an attitude. And it was an attitude of humility rather than control. That this whole sense that we can control the world, we can make a jump through the hoops that we set up. This was a book that talked about how to work on wild land without taming it. It's like that editorial principle that I was talking about. You look for the good in something and you edit around the good. You take a piece of land and you look at the strengths of it, you look at the beauty of it, and you make certain that you preserve what's beautiful and what's strong about it.
The last time we talked, I think, was in the course of working on a conference, the California Commons. Seems like the Commons is a concept that which has, you know, made a comeback in the last years. Do you find it useful in thinking about what we've been talking about and what you're working on?
Yeah, I do. I do. I find there's the concept of the Commons as a geographical concept, as a legal concept. But what I'm also interested in is the intellectual commons, is what I've been watching. I think one of the greatest changes that I've seen in my life is the increasing use of language for selling, for salesmanship, that even people that have ideas sell their ideas. There's a sense of commercialization of the institutions around us. There's people sell themselves. They see themselves as products, and they have resumes, and they have Wikipedia entries, and they manage themselves as if they were a company. And there's a whole other way of doing things that I think has more to do with the commons, where we see each other as a community. We see each other as we understand the free space between people. And it strikes me that that it's the most valuable kind of concept is the concept of the commons, and it is coming back, Cal. And I think the work that you've done in it has been really great. I think the work that you've done on utopian communities is really great.
Well, that's very nice to hear. Are you talking about West of Eden?
Yeah.
I should mention that if you don't mind.
Please do. I thought it was a great piece of work.
Communes and Utopia in Northern California, published last year. Well, Malcolm, this has been very interesting and enlightening, illuminating, as it always is in talking to you.
www.heydaybooks.com for anybody that wants to.
Okay.
Plug in.
And they certainly should do that, because there's a lot there that we haven't even got close to. discussing. So I'll just thank you again and say that this is our program this morning is talking about California, and we've been talking to Malcolm Margolin, and he's the publisher of Heyday Press. We've just heard how to find out about it, and it's a magnificent list of books and publications and periodicals and events can be found out about there, and we were talking about some. Just to remind you, if you want to jot them down before we're finished, a first book might take some searching, The Ohlone Way, other books, Native Ways, The Way We Lived, The Earth Manual, a wonderful collection of thinking and description, and I would certainly encourage all of the listeners to find out about Heyday Press and the topics that it works in and the world that it works in. So that will be it for this morning. Malcolm, thanks again.
Well, thank you, Bill.
And listeners, thank you. And we'll be back next Thursday at the same time. Get ready for the fund drives, the ubiquitous fund drive. So you should make a special point of listening next week and getting involved and seeing to it that KCYX continues and that we're able to continue to have Malcolm join us for conversations like the one this morning. Thanks and good morning.